have you work with me to fill in the blanks on the board, and I'll tell you in a minute what the premise is behind this grid, this chart. We're going to look at three of the broad ethical frameworks, sets of ethical tools that people use for approaching issues of war and peace. Whether we realize it or not, I think we all tend to use ethical tools and sets of values for dealing with issues like peace and war. And we want to look at three of them this afternoon that are around and that are fairly present in our society and may even be present in all of us to a degree. That is, we are all a mixture, perhaps, of two or three of these. My name is Charles Lutz, and I've been working with issues of war and peace over a period of about 15 years, since the Vietnam War, actually, when I did some work for the Lutherans in this country around issues of the draft and conscientious objection and war and conscience. I'd like to begin by quoting from one of the prophets of our time, Irma Bombeck. How many of you read Irma Bombeck regularly? Do you get to see Irma in your papers? Well, she wrote this a couple years ago. She said, a group of women were sitting around the other night discussing what we would do if we were invited to a war. And they decided they could think of some ways to terminate it rather quickly. And I'll just share a few of those. I suggested the best way to stop a war was to ask the men directions on how to get there. We'd never find it. Or put the war in the hands of the post office. It might not stop it, but it would certainly slow it down. Assign children to war zones and tell them they have to clean their rooms before they can go. Tell your husband it's something he has to dress up for. This is Irma Bombeck on how to stop a war. And one more that I think I understand, but I'm not sure. Some of you probably will catch it better than others. Have one-size-fits-all uniforms that are issued in little eggs. See, some of you got it. If you can position yourselves where you can see the board, I think it'll be helpful, because we're going to use this as a matrix for charting three ethical systems as they apply to the issue of peace and war. The heading on the top is Christians and the Use of Armed Force. Now, two of these are pretty well recognized as ethics for war and peace. One is pacifism. We're all familiar with that position, I think. It's fairly easy to comprehend because it's an absolute position on the use of armed force. Another one is the just, unjust war tradition, which has been around at least since the time of St. Augustine, and probably in some form prior to that, which admits the use of armed force under certain circumstances and tries to condition, qualify the use of armed force. The third one that is not usually recognized as an ethical position on war, but I think it is, I think it's maybe the dominant one in our society right now, is the one I've labeled national self-interest. That's the ethic which says whatever my nation requires is the highest value. And if that requires use of military force, so be it. So what I'm going to try to do is spell out with your help. I'll invite you to help me fill in the blanks, because I think once you get the premise of this, you can do it too. What are the eight items that run across the chart? What is the stance of each on the use of armed force? What is its primary ethical witness regarding war and peace? The central value. Each has a route to peace. Each of these claims to be an ethic for keeping the peace or for making peace. None of them is a positive ethic of war. They don't, any of them, want to be understood that way. They are ethics for peace. Is there biblical support for it? We might be able to get into a debate about that. What is the attitude of governing authority to it, specifically our own governing authority, our own set of laws? What is the stance of U.S. Lutheran bodies toward it? I say U.S. Lutheran bodies because I'm familiar with those positions. They're pretty much similar to the other mainline Christian bodies in this country. The peace churches would have a different stance, of course, and we'll get into that. And what is the weakness of each? Because I think each does have a weakness. Each has an imperfection. the stance, I don't know if I stand up, I don't know if I can still see you. I think I can still make eye contact with you.
Crouch.
Okay. If any of you want to move up closer to the front, feel free.
Right on that board.
What is the stance of pacifism on the use of armed force? Anybody?
No.
Never.
That's right. It's an uncompromising refusal. That's what makes it pacifism. As soon as you say, well, maybe under certain circumstances, you cease to be a pacifist. That is a traditional, classical pacifist. So it's uncompromising refusal. What is the stance of the unjust war tradition regarding the use of force? Lethal force we're talking about now.
Only in a just cause under specific criteria.
Right. It's selective participation or support or objection to war based on criteria. So selective participation or objection, this is now the individual person or the group of persons, based on criteria. Now we have to stop here, I think, and spend a little bit of time on what those criteria are. Traditionally, you can find various kinds of lists, but they all pretty much come out with the same content. And let's just quickly review them without spending a great deal of time on them. There are traditionally several criteria when contemplating warfare that must be met. And then there are several criteria when conducting warfare. That is the rules of war. It is not so that anything goes in war, according to this ethic. Maybe in love, but not in war. When contemplating warfare, the traditional criteria include just cause. It must have a just cause. What is a just cause? To expand your territory? Basically defense. Basically the only justifiable cause for war in this ethic is defense. Aggressive pursuits are not justifiable. It's to be a last resort. That is, you are to try all non-violent means for resolving the conflict first. And of course, that's a criterion that's almost never satisfied, because we almost never, it seems to me, if you look at the history of warfare, almost never are other pursuits exhausted. Just think in recent times of one the United States was not directly involved with, the Malvinas-Falklands dispute. Was war there a last resort? Was everything else tried? I don't think so. And yet it was a war. It was a fairly short war. But in terms of the numbers of people involved, a very bloody war. I think the death toll was 1,800 people, which was about the population of the island. Probably all out of proportion to any military objective that could be achieved. And yet, because nations had the ability to go to war, they went to war over that. It was not a last resort. It is to be declared by the constituted authority of the nation. And that's why, in olden times at least, you had in constitutions of democracies provision for declaration of war. We have it in our constitution. What is it? Who can take us into war?
Congress.
Only the Congress can declare war. Presidents can ask Congress to do it, but only Congress can declare war according to our constitution. Which, of course, is one reason that many people felt the Vietnam War, our involvement in it, was illegitimate, because Congress never declared it. Likewise today, our Congress has not declared war against Nicaragua, and yet we're behaving in a warlike manner against Nicaragua. So some of that traditional adherence to declaration by constituted authority has broken down, and it doesn't fit a civil war, a guerrilla war, very well, a war of insurrection within a nation. But that's one of the classical tests of what is a just war. One reason for that, apparently, was that gives a nation an opportunity to declare to other nations, including its adversary, why it feels justified in going to war. And if you want a very clear statement of that, look at the Declaration of Independence. Declaration of Independence is a statement of why the 13 colonies felt justified in taking up arms against Great Britain. And it's an appeal to the community of nations to understand our cause and our reasons. War is supposed to be justifiable, it's supposed to have a reasonable prospect of success. That is, you cannot justifiably take a people into war if it's a suicidal thing, even if the cause is just and all the other criteria met. War is to have a winner, the possibility of a winner. And unless there is a possibility that you can win the war, you're not justified as a national leader in taking your people into it. Annihilation is not a legitimate reason to go to war. Well, then some tests for the conduct of warfare, which have pretty much been written into international law. They're broken, they're not always abided by, but they are there as international covenants that can be appealed to. And to some extent, after war is ended, they are used by the victors to prosecute the vanquished. It's interesting that the losers of war never get to conduct war trials. It's only the winners that get to conduct war trials, as we did after World War II. One of the key ones is non-combatant immunity. Those who are not combatants, those who are not armed, those who are not soldiers, are to be respected as immune, not to be targeted. Now, civilians always suffer during war, even under the best of circumstances. And that's part of what happens in warfare. But they are not to be targeted under the rules of a just war. Therefore, the bombing of the saturation bombing of civilian targets during World War II by both sides was illegitimate on the basis of this theory, this ethic. It was done, but it was not justifiable according to this ethic. There's the test of proportionality. That is, you do not use force, weapon systems that are disproportionate to the military objective. And finally, there's a criterion that has to do with mercy to the vanquished. Once the war is over, you stop the enmity and you behave toward the vanquished as though the hostility is ended. Well, these are important, I think, still today, even though many people say there can no longer be a just war in a nuclear age. I would agree with that. Using nuclear weapons, you cannot have a just war. But that's precisely why these criteria are important. The criteria themselves rule out the use of nuclear weapons on any basis of the traditional tests. Yes? Well, they've evolved over the centuries, beginning really with, in the Christian West, St. Augustine, who said, now that Christians are in charge of empire. See, for the first three centuries, this was pretty universal, the ethic of believers, when they didn't have to run things politically. They weren't in charge of empire. That is, we weren't. The believers were a minority, and they were a persecuted minority, and they refused to fight. And one reason they were persecuted was they refused to fight for the empire. Suddenly, after Constantine, Christians were running things. Before that, they could say with Jesus, our kingdom is not of this world. Now, suddenly, they were running a kingdom of this world. They were running empire. And they had to deal with things like self-defense and guarding the borders and dealing with the barbarians. At least that was the justification. And St. Augustine said, therefore, we need an ethic that is a concession to that reality. Really a concession to the fact of human sin. I mean, you could put it that way. That's what it is. It's a compromise and accommodation. And the just war tradition has always been that. It has not wanted to justify war as a positive good, but to say, is the absence of war the highest value? And they concluded, no, it was not. There are higher values than nonviolence. That's what it came down to, as we'll see when we get into this chart. Now, let me move to the third column, national self-interest. What is the stance of national self-interest on the use of armed force, would you say? In its pure form.
What is the national interest in its justified to use force?
Mm-hmm. It's justifiable to use, if my government says it's required in our self-interest to do this military thing, then I go along with that, because the highest value is whatever my government requires, whatever my political system says is required in our national self-interest. Now, I don't think many people will go along with that 100%, but a lot of people will go quite a ways with that. You hear it when people say, well, what do I know? I don't know enough. I'm not an expert. I don't know. Maybe we do need to do such and so, and I just follow my leaders. And in a democracy where we tend to accept, or we have until recent times at least, the word of our political leadership, that something is necessary, and we feel that we are finally in control of the system, it's fairly easy to go along with that theory. So uncritical compliance, in its purest form, it would be uncritical compliance with governmental requirements. You heard it during the Vietnam War when people said, well, I don't like this war, I don't like any war, particularly this one, but if my government says we have to fight it, I guess we have to fight it. And who am I to question it? Because I don't really know. I leave it to the experts. That kind of attitude would flow from that set of values. The second category, ethical witness. We've pretty much alluded to it already. Pacifism says about war what? War is always wrong or the worst wrong. It's the worst sin. If you have a choice between war and no war, war is always the worst sin. And I put it that way because that contrasts it with the just unjust war position, which says war is always sinful, but it may not be the worst sin. It's a kind of lesser evil ethic about war. It doesn't say war is a positive good. It says it's always an evil, but may not be worst evil. That is, there may be things worse than war. And on that basis, people have justified going to war, of course. The lack of freedom, defense against attack, those may be, or the need to defend against attack, that may be a higher need than the need of nonviolence. The ethical witness here, it seems to me, is that the states or the governments' military policies are always legitimate. Always legit. Central value. Each has a central value, I believe. The central value of pacifism is, how would you put it? Nonviolence, non-resisting love. Sometimes it's put that way. The way to oppose an enemy is with non-resistance, that is non-force resistance, love. The central value of the just unjust war tradition is what?
Restraint.
Okay, think of the first criterion, just cause. What can justify going to war?
Self-defense.
Defense of the innocent. Defense of the innocent. That's really where Augustine began. His problem was, now that Christians had to run empire, had to rule, what was the obligation of political authority to defend the innocent from attack? That was his central ethical concern. And he said, on the basis of that, unsavory as it is, because he did not like war or violence, he said, as a lesser evil, the use of armed force in defense can be justified. Because not to do so means there are other neighbors you can't love, those you're obliged to love because they are the ones who look to you for protection. So in a way, he was saying you have to choose between two sets of neighbors. Which neighbors to love? Those who are attacking your country or those who are dependent on you for defense? Yeah.
I'm sorry to go back to something before, but I think I missed, how do you define non-resisting when you say non-resisting love?
Well, love that...
Are you talking about a violent resistance, is that what you, or non-resisting?
It's non-violent, and it's non-resisting in the sense that it does not resist with armed force.
Okay, with arms, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah. It's what...
it can be resistance.
Oh, yeah, it is resistance. It's what some of the Scandinavian countries tried with the Nazis with some success.
Fine.
They did not continue to fight with force, but they continued to resist in a variety of ways.
Sure.
Civilian defense, not, as we know it, bomb shelter, that type, but civilian non-armed force, or non-armed resistance. Okay, defense of the innocent or correcting injustice, particularly as a last resort. And I would remind us today to look to situations like that of Namibia, where for a long time the Namibian liberation groups tried non-violent means of securing their freedom from South Africa, and with continual rebuff, and finally turned to the use of armed force, just as the Zimbabweans did and others have, and as we did, as the United States did. In fact, we probably had less cause than some of the people in today's world who are fighting for their freedom, like the Namibians. They are using armed force to try to win their freedom from South Africa.
What about territory? That doesn't appear anywhere.
What do you mean by to gain territory?
No, just an unjust war. If someone wants to take part of your country, is that a just war to resist militarily? Mm-hmm.
It's usually defined so, to defend your borders. Yeah, to keep your borders secure is a legitimate reason for using force. The central value of national self-interest, ethic.
So that would be, say, under correcting injustice. It was unjust of them to try to take part of my land, so I'm now correcting the injustice by fighting back and taking back what was mine.
And the Namibians are saying it is unjust of South Africa to continue to occupy and rule our territory, our land, and that's been declared that way by the highest authority, the International Court of Justice. And most nations of the world, I think all nations except South Africa, recognize that as a legitimate judgment. And if the only way we can get our country and the right to rule ourselves is by force, we're going to use armed force. That is, there is nothing in the tradition of the Namibian people. There may be individuals there, but there's nothing in their tradition, church or otherwise, that says they must be pacifists. They tend to follow the same kind of ethic that most Western Christians have followed since Constantine. National self-interest, central value, I think it's obedience to government. Obedience to authority. And security or peace through military strength. Security through strength. And that is an ethic. That is, people have a set of values that surround that position and adhere to it very strongly. I think it's basic to the deterrence theory. Or the way to keep peace in the world today between the US and the Soviet Union is for us to be militarily as strong as we can be. Some would even say stronger than they, some would say no, the same strength as they to keep a parity. But peace through military strength is a very strong ethic in our country, and it's probably present in many of us to a degree. The route to peace, each of these has a route to peace. The route to peace of pacifism is how? How do you deal with conflict in the pacifist ethic?
Love and understanding.
Well, you recognize conflict, first of all. Pacifists are not naive about conflict. They recognize that there is conflict, there will be conflicts in the world between nations, and they have to be resolved, they have to be dealt with. Okay? Whatever the means, they are to be nonviolent. Nonviolent resolution of conflict is the route to peace, and that can take many forms. But nonviolent resolution of conflict. The route to peace in the just unjust war tradition is
to win.
Well, again, remember, it's a last resort. Deal with the root causes. Deal with the causes of the injustice that may lead to armed conflict, and then use restraint in entering and prosecuting war. It is not as though anything goes in war. Use restraint. Deal with causes and use restraint. We may be able to argue a bit about whether that has in fact worked, whether the just war tradition has restrained war. Some say it hasn't very much, at least. Some say it has more than we realize. At least the international accords governing what is permitted in warfare came out of this tradition, and they have been, in past centuries, adhered to more or less. I think the basic restraint on the conduct of warfare is self-interest. That is, if you don't respect the right of my civilians not to be attacked, I won't respect the right of your civilians not to be targeted. So I think the self-interest of both sides. Or if you don't stop, if you don't use gas, nerve gas, nerve gas has basically, I think, been retired because you couldn't control it. It came back on your own troops. It came back on your own populations in World War I. That's why both sides stopped using it. So there's, again, a self-interest involved. But to some extent, the reason nuclear weapons have not been used for 38 years, once both sides had them, or 35 years, whatever it is, I think, is the mutual self-interest argument, that we both fear that the other side will use them if we use them. And I think that has been a factor. It doesn't deal with the possibility of accidental use or use by someone who's gone mad or use out of great fear that if we don't do it to them first, they'll do it to us, whatever. But it has, after a fashion, kept the peace between the superpowers, and I think basically out of self-interest on both sides. Okay, the route to peace of national self-interest is, we've already suggested, be prepared to fight with strong force. Be prepared to fight with strong force.
Last thing I want to do is talk for the self-interest point of view, but I think also in that route there's a lot of economic factors which are, it's a way of strangling people or getting your way. It sounds like violent in the sense of it can hurt people, but it's not necessarily use of military force, which I think is also a route to peace used by the national self-interest.
Yeah, there's a lot left out of this because we're basically focusing on the use of armed force, ethics for armed force, but you're right, you know, the economic factors are certainly major. Now, let me ask you.
Is that included in the national self-interest?
Just in fact, that would be part of this line. The route to peace is deterrence. That is the threat of we used to call it mutually assured destruction, will keep the peace, or will keep both sides from using the weapons in the nuclear context. Let me ask you if you think there's biblical support for each of these. Is there biblical support for pacifism?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, what's your evidence? What do you point to?
Love your enemy.
Okay. All right. Peter told to put up his sword. All of those. Okay. Do you believe that Jesus Christ is a figure of nonviolence?
He said, "I didn't come to bring peace."
Okay.
A lot of people is revolutionary. Well,
nonviolent revolutionary. I think most Christians would agree that Jesus Christ is a figure of nonviolence. Why then are not all Christians nonviolent? Why aren't we all pacifists?
Because it gets starting to get into some of those other categories.
Yeah. I think it's the same problem that faced Augustine and the Christians after Constantine. How to accommodate to the reality.
I'm not sure all Christians think he was nonviolent either.
Right. Well, you may be right. I think I would argue that most would, if you press them, say, yeah, Jesus probably is and was nonviolent himself and called his followers to be. Okay, then is there biblical support for this middle column, this just unjust war tradition?
The Old Testament. Biblical.
Okay. For me, the basic biblical support is not in a single passage you can point to, but it's in the high value that the biblical tradition gives to justice. I really think that if you press it, at least the Old Testament tradition, the Shalom tradition, gives higher value to justice than to nonviolence. But that tells you that I'm not a pacifist. You know, I have great respect for the pacifist tradition. I think we need more of the pacifist witness among us today. But I basically come to my position on war and the use of the non-use of nuclear weapons on the basis of the just war tradition. And I may change next month or next year, but that's basically where I am. And to support it biblically, I look to the value that the Bible places on justice, that I think comes in the whole weight of it, at least, trying to deal with the complexities of the kingdoms of this world and the kingdoms of my kingdom, not of this world, the strong support that comes out for justice in the human order.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The way it's been applied historically, and I think the way it's written now, I think it needs more work to be biblical. Because in order for me to say that biblical support, I think we need to start adding on some serious looking at have all our alternatives been looked at first as a way of gaining justice. And also, when I look at the Old Testament, the biggest thing that comes through to me, and I think of war, and I'm sure you've looked at it a lot more than I have, is the idea of is whether or not it's justice or not is based on God. Is God with us in this?
That's right.
And that criteria takes a heck of a lot more study than, well, they've crossed our borders, so we have to fight back. I've somehow put more emphasis on how hard you search before you go to war and how hard you look for alternatives, and that you're armed with those alternatives to begin with, instead of armed with a violent alternative to begin with, which I think is what we have done historically.
Yeah, we easily slip into war as an earlier than last resort because we're prepared for it, and we're not prepared to do the other kind of conflict resolving.
Right.
We give very little resources as a nation to compared to the military resort to other ways of resolving conflict, which I think is one of the main arguments behind the creation of a National Peace Academy, by the way.
Yes.
We have three military academies, okay, we're not going to close them probably, but let's at least have one academy devoted to the academic study and preparation of people for nonviolent resolution of conflict. And you know, that's still tied up in the Congress and may someday be voted through, but it still hasn't been.
What do we have, 5 war colleges?
Yeah, those are the military's own graduate schools. There's
but
one
they're
for
called war
they're
college.
Called war colleges, yeah, which is an interesting name. The other thing I was going to say on that point we were just on is John Howard Yoder has rendered a real service to the tradition that most of us come from, if we're part of the just war tradition, with this little book, When War is Unjust, Being Honest in Just War Thinking. John Howard Yoder, as you may know, is a pacifist, a Mennonite, but he wants to take seriously the just war tradition as part of the framework, the ethical framework of war and peace in our time, and wants us who are part of that tradition to take it seriously and to follow where it leads. And he points out very lucidly in this book that where it really leads is to conflict with your own government. Because governments tend not to take it seriously. They give lip service to it at best. If they want to fight a war, they'll find a justifiable reason for fighting it. But he says people who are in that tradition ethically need to take it seriously, even if that means saying no to your government and being therefore in conflict with your government. And he goes into some of these issues that we've just been talking about, that we do not tend to take it very seriously. We're inclined to say, well, we have a just war tradition. My government says this war is just, therefore it's just, without running it by the criteria, without testing it against the criteria. And I commend this to you. It's in the bookstore. I want to read from it a little later. Well, with your permission, I'll put down a yes here and agree that it needs more work. By the way, the just war tradition, as Yoder points out in this book, is really not what you could call a Christian position at all. I don't even know if you can say that about pacifism, because there have been pacifists who are non-Christians. But pacifism, I think, has worked out a much more complete theological basis than the just war tradition has. The just war tradition, after all, is really human reason. That's what it is. If you're going to allow for war, how do you constrain it? How do you restrain it? How do you keep it from being more damaging than it needs to be? And how do you discourage the entry into it? That's what that theory is all about. And if you ask what's the biblical basis for it, you know, it's hard to point to it. Because I think it's basically human rationality. Yeah, Darius.
Yeah, do you think that most of us who claim the just war tradition really operate from a national self-interest rather than a just war?
That's what Yoder says in his book. People who say they are here are really functionally here.
Because what really happens is that the burden of proof is on the people saying it's unjust, rather than in the just war tradition, the burden of proof is to prove that it's just.
Mm-hmm.
And so we assume it's just, rather than, I think if we're faithful to a tradition, we assume it's unjust until somebody proves it's just.
Yeah, recall the Vietnam War. The burden of proof was always on the young man, we were drafting only males, who said, for me, this is an activity I cannot participate in. He had to prove to the system that he had reason to be a conscientious objector. And if his objection was based on this tradition, that is, it depends on the circumstances, he couldn't qualify under our law. Because our law said you have to be opposed to all war, war in general, war per se. If you pick and choose your war, you don't qualify. That is what our law says. So the burden of proof has always been, even for the draft age young person, on proving that he sincerely believed it was unjust for him. Well, the theory behind this ethic is the opposite, that war has to be justified. The proof of it, the prince, Luther wrote a lot about it, your prince has to be able to demonstrate to you that he's properly following the ethic in calling you into war. But because government has the power, also the power to conscript people, government almost never has satisfied that requirement. That's a very helpful point. Biblical support for national self-interest, for that ethic.
There's support for how foolish it is, I think.
Well, people tend to appeal to some biblical support for obedience to authority.
Oh, yeah, Romans 13.
Yep, Romans 13 always gets quoted right off the bat. So what do you say about that? What do you do with that? Are they wrong? Was Paul wrong? Was that is that something that doesn't belong in the Bible?
Well, you have to interpret it. I mean, that passage is set within words about love all around it.
Yeah.
I think if that one in particular needs careful interpretation. It just doesn't blankly support anything.
I agree. Paul goes on to define government that should be obeyed as that which rewards good and punishes evil, not the reverse of that. And I think that's there. And I think also we need to say that obedience to authority is a value. For me, it is not near the highest value, but it is a value. In any society, there needs to be some allegiance to order and to authority. And I think that's what Paul is getting at. He may also have been writing in the midst of the Roman Empire's oppression of Christians. I mean, we don't know all of what was going on when he wrote those words. But that's the passage, and a similar one in Peter, I think it's 1 Peter, that is usually appealed to by people who say Lutherans have been very strong in that. Martin Marty says, the primary contribution of Lutherans in the United States to the church-state debate, or the discussion of obedience to authority, has been the Council of Obedience. That's been our primary contribution. As a church historian, that's what he feels. That's been what we have majored in. We have majored in the Council of Obedience. That may be changing, but I think he's right that that's where we have been.
Well, would that include our supporting a police system that shoots people?
Well, according to the interpretation of Paul and 1 Peter that I would feel comfortable with, it does not require that we obey governments which themselves are immoral or unjust. And when you talk about civil disobedience, I do not think it has very much to do with the obedience to specific laws. I think it is rather a matter of respect for the authority which is government, for the structure of government, for the fact of order, the need for order. Paul and Peter both were arrested many times for breaking specific laws in conscience. So I do not think you can take it from saying, I have respect for the system of law, therefore I have to obey every individual law that comes along, even if it violates my conscience. I don't think that the two go together, necessarily.
Does it have anything to do with passages that refer to righteousness? Being right with God, why?
Say some more about that.
Well, it just seems to me that when the Bible talks about righteousness and righteous Christians and being righteous, it flows in with these passages and so forth. And I was wondering if there was a connection in being a righteous Christian and these passages. Maybe not. Confused you, Haven?
I'm not sure. Part of my problem is the word righteousness is often translated in some Bibles, at least in Catholic Bibles, more typically as justice. And if we are righteous before God, that means we are declared just before God, as in justification by faith. I think the basic problem for Christians is that we are at one and the same time citizens of a kingdom which has an ethic from outside this order, and we're citizens of a kingdom which is clearly of this world. And sometimes those two conflict. And lordship of Christ conflicts, and our discipleship and allegiance to Christ may conflict with our allegiance to our own government. Even in good government, under relatively good governments, I think that will be the case. And then how do we deal with that? And if we say, the way to deal with that is always to obey the human government, I think that's very dangerous, because then you're making of human government God, a God. That's the final authority. But if you say the other, it means you may have to go to jail. And you may give offense to fellow believers who don't agree with you. Whatever it is. Resistance to...
William Stringfellow has said that the point of these passages is to honor the office of the emperor.
Yeah.
And therefore it may mean to get rid of or try to help change who the emperor is in order to keep that office, you know, what it's intended to be. And lots of times it's been corrupted at that time.
That would be my position, that what Paul is talking about in Romans 13 is the institution of government, not any particular government's requirements, because they come and go, and they can be wrong. And laws, you know, Martin Luther King was very clear about, unjust racial laws do not have to be obeyed. They have to be opposed. And one way of opposing them is to disobey them and to make a witness against them by going to jail. And that is not, it seems to me, a violation at all of Romans 13, which says, respect the institution of government, which is the institution of order and authority in human society.
Out of respect for your charge in that sense, I would take Romans, whatever you started to put off there, and put no, simply because the way you've designed to define national self-interest, I can't find support for it biblically. The way you've defined it is using force simply because the nation says you do, and that ignores the reality that sometimes God comes before nations. In my opinion, I think...
Okay, I would not put down an unqualified yes there. I think I would put down something like very little. But I do recognize that people who are comfortable in this column appeal to biblical sources to support the idea of obedience to government. And I think that's basically what this column is all about. It's about obedience to government and leaving it to our leaders, because they know best. So, well, you can fill in whatever you like there. Let's try to finish this quickly, and then maybe we'll have a little time left for some additional discussion. Attitude of governing authorities toward pacifism. Take the United States government and our legal system. What is its attitude toward pacifism?
I'm opposed to it.
Unrealistic.
Is it opposed?
To government? It permits barely tolerates it.
I'd say it's at least toleration, because our law provides for it, allows for it. I would say it's reluctant acceptance, as long as it's a minority viewpoint. And the history of the United States has been a gradual broadening of the definition of who qualifies, but always against the resistance of the legislative bodies and of the military. The courts have done it. We began with the definition of a legal CO was one who came from a peace church and had a religious basis. You had to belong to a Quaker or Mennonite or Church of the Brethren community to qualify. Then it was broadened to include any religious conviction. You could be a Lutheran or a Catholic or a Methodist and be recognized as a pacifist. But it had to be a theist. It had to be a God-believing basis. And it wasn't until the Vietnam War that the Supreme Court said that is unfair to those who are not theists and are also pacifists. So now you can be a non-theist claimant for CO status if there's a draft. But it's been a struggle to get it broadened that much. You still do not qualify as a war objector legally if you aren't opposed to all war. If you're anywhere outside this column, you can't qualify. So the attitude of governing authority toward pacifism, as measured by our draft law at least, would be reluctant acceptance as long as it's a small minority that's claiming it. I've often wondered, what would happen if 51% of us in a particular time were pacifists? Would the law still work? Would the draft still function? But I suppose governments can accept this as long as they see it as a small minority that can be abided. What about this column? What is the attitude of governing authority toward the national self-interest column?
It's run along with it.
Yeah.
The last few years.
I would say it's congenial because, of course, it doesn't challenge governing authority. It's ironic because I think it's the position that a majority of Americans hold, and it's to some degree what our government recognizes as the ethical framework for war. It's taught to a large degree in the military to officers. the rules of warfare coming out of this. So there's some acceptance of it. But I think in terms of fighting a war, there's great discomfort about the position. Why? Because it challenges particular policies of governments. It doesn't say I'm opposed to war per se. It says I'm opposed to this particular war. Remember the slogan from the Vietnam years, what if they gave a war and nobody came? It has that kind of threat to governments. It gets in the way. So I would say the attitude of governing authority of our government, Republicans or Democrats, with this position is great discomfort. Because people who are in this position necessarily will be making political judgments, policy judgments. Is this a just or unjust cause? Like my son, when he was 18 or 19, when you had to register for the draft a few years ago, and they revived registration, he was at that age, and he had to do it. He said, Mom and Dad, I think I'm a conscientious objector. And we said, well, let's talk about that. Well, it turned out that he said, well, I don't think I would have any trouble fighting to defend my country if we were attacked, but I can't see going to the Middle East to defend our oil interests. Well, that put him in the column of a just, unjust war objector, and he did not qualify for a CO claim if there had been a draft. So he wasn't an all-war objector. He was making judgments about particular circumstances. Official stance of U.S. Lutheran bodies: we have supported individuals who stand here, even though Lutherans have not been a peace church. The Augsburg Confession says very clearly, and I think most Lutherans are still there today, Christians, believers in this movement called Lutheran, may engage in just wars. The other side of that is we ought not engage in unjust wars. But we've also said that pacifists among us are legitimate in their ethic and have a right to be there, and we support them as individuals. We have given official commitment to this, but as was pointed out by Darius, I think most Lutheran people find themselves more comfortable over here, because we've had a great deal of difficulty with the idea of disobeying government. So I think functionally, we've more often been there. The other thing is we haven't taught this tradition very well to our people. Most of them don't know much about it. So it's kind of meaningless to say, well, we're part of that tradition when we don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say that each of these has a certain weakness. You may disagree. It seems to me the weakness of pacifism is not that it's wrong, but that it's dismissed, easily dismissed, as an idealistic position of a small minority. That means people tend not to take it seriously as a political force, because it's easily dismissed as, well, it's just a few kooks at the edge, at the fringe. That is maybe not a weakness of pacifism itself, but in terms of a political force, it is dismissed easily that way. I think the obvious weakness of the just unjust war column is that it's been ineffective as a restraint on national war making. I think the best you can say about it is that it's helped to frame some of the international codes that govern the conduct of warfare, like the treatment of prisoners, the immunity of civilians, and so on. And theoretically, at least, some weapon systems have been dealt with out of this tradition, nerve gas being the most obvious in this century. But it hasn't yet been able to retire nuclear weapons on the same grounds. We still have them. We're still making them. And yet they clearly do not meet the criteria of a just what would be just weaponry. So it's been ineffective as a restraint on national war making. Because any war any government ever wants to fight, they always justify to their people as just. They say, no nation ever says, folks, let's go to war here, but it's unjust, but let's do it anyway. That is never said. I think it has also had some value, not incidental value, as a guide for individuals who have to wrestle in their own consciences with the morality of going to war. And that's been its greatest value in our time. And the writings of Luther and other reformers at that point are very helpful. That if you believe your prince is wrong, Luther said, in commanding you to go to war, you must say no, even under penalty of death, because it is not right to go against conscience. Martin Luther was very strong on the priority of conscience. Even if conscience was misguided, he said, you must follow conscience or you tear yourself apart. You can try to get your conscience changed, but as long as that's where your conscience is, don't disobey it. And he illustrated that himself at Worms. You know, he appealed to conscience there, as well as to the scriptures. Finally, the weakness of national self-interest is the obvious one. It leaves the policy decisions to the experts. It leaves it to those who know best. So I've sometimes labeled this column passivism. Not pacifism, but passivism. Because people tend to become passive about the policy debate, saying simply, I leave it to my leaders. They know best. And as a faithful, loyal citizen, I should follow. Now, let me conclude by reading a paragraph from Yoder. It happens to be his last paragraph. In sum, the challenge ought to be clear. If the tradition which claims that war may be justified does not also admit that it could be unjustified, the affirmation is not morally serious. A Christian who prepares the case for a justified war without being equally prepared for the negative case has not soberly weighed the prima facie presumption that any violence is wrong until the case for an exception has been made. He's arguing that this is about the exception. And that's absolutely correct in terms of the origin of that tradition. He goes on, we honor the moral seriousness of the non-pacifist Christian when we spell out the criteria by which the credibility of that seriousness must be judged. And that's really all that his book is about, calling us non-pacifist Christians to account and to take seriously our own tradition and to follow where it leads. The other book that I want to call to your attention, if you're interested in this literature, is this one, Peaceways, which Jerry Folk and I put together a year or so ago. It's a collection of essays from a variety of disciplines on the nuclear threat and the morality of the nuclear dilemma and where we should go with that, based both on pacifist and non-pacifist presuppositions. Both of those are available in the library and in the bookstore. Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left.
Why do you think that, I would assume that about 70% of the United States, there are at least the religious background supports, at least the majority supports the just war, you know, camp.
Their religious traditions do, yeah.
Catholic, Lutheran,
yes, yes.
Methodist. But why? My son just went wild. Why do you think it has not been taught in our churches? Why do you think most of us really are more into the national self-interest camp? What do you propose that we can do to? I mean, moving to pacifism, that's not the question. The question is, how can we claim our own tradition?
Yeah. I think there are two or three reasons, some of which we've already alluded to. One certainly is that this one requires people to make judgments about every circumstance that comes along. These two, in a way, are much easier because they're extremes, they're absolutes. This one, it's very, very easy. Once you've decided that war is always the worst evil, it's decided. You don't have to struggle with every issue that comes along. It's almost like, if I may say so, abortion. If you've decided that abortion is always the worst evil, in any circumstance, to have an abortion is the worst sin. That decides it. Then you don't have to struggle with it every time the issue comes along. It's already determined. Likewise, if you've decided that whatever my government requires of me is the thing to do, that decides it. You don't have to get involved yourself with the messiness of making judgments. This is a gray area. So it's difficult to struggle with. I think the Catholic bishop's letter is very good on that. They admit, too, that they haven't taught it very well in their tradition. But it's the basic reason they give for their argument about nuclear weapons, the pastoral letter of last year. I think also this one has been uncomfortable for Christians to be in because it does lead inevitably to conflict at some point with governing authority. And if you're as law-abiding as most Lutheran Christians are and have wanted to be, it's very difficult to follow where this leads because this will lead into conflict, as we found in the Vietnam War. We had most of the Lutheran young people who had problems with that war of conscience were selective objectors. Selective objectors invariably are in conflict with their government, as long as that position isn't recognized as a legitimate one. So you have the irony that the ethical position shared by most Americans, at least in theory, the churches of most Americans, religious tradition of most, is not recognized by our government. But one that's shared by only a minority of us is recognized by our government. And I think it's because of the numbers involved. To recognize this position would cause great difficulty in operating a military system, if you had to rely on a draft, at least. So I think those are some of the reasons. There may be others, but it seems to me it has mostly to do with this being a gray area, and that's a lot more difficult. That people still like to have someone tell them, now what is the right or wrong of this? As with abortion, I think people, it is simply easier if somebody will tell you it's okay or it's not okay. It's a lot more difficult if somebody says, well, it depends on the circumstances. If somebody says, as some of the church positions have said, it's always an evil, it's always sinful, but it may not be the worst evil. There may be circumstances in which it is less evil to have an abortion than not to. That makes you, throws you back on your own judgments. You have to make up, you have to study, you have to think, you have to reflect, and that's always more painful than having a clean black or white answer. Same thing with war, I think. Nancy?
And I said, and you have to take responsibility for the decision that you made.
That's right.
It wasn't because somebody else told you to do it. It's because you decided it's good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.